Preble High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you very much for attending today. You may be seated. Are there other students present in the room? Would they stand? And tell me where you're from. Green Bay East. Good. Well, you're welcome too. You're just not on my list. You may be seated. These students are here with our Poet with Class program. And the teacher, Ms. Kolstad, won't you stand, please? It's good to see you again, Ms. Kolstad. You're a graduate of the Justice Teaching Institute. You may be seated. And both
only that, she was the Chief Justice when we had our exercise, so.
Doesn't count today. Both the Court with Class program and the Teaching Institute, Justice Teaching Institute, are programs conducted by the Supreme Court in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And the Court with Class program is, as some of you know, a national award-winning program, and I think our Justice Teaching Institute is on its way. So we want to thank you all for coming. The students have received information about the case that they're about to hear. They may have had lawyers or other people come in and discuss the case with them. And part of our program is also to meet with a justice at noon to discuss the procedures of the co-ed, not the substance of the cases. And I believe all the students did meet this noon, and this noon's justice was a Justice Crux. So we have met all of you, so let me formally introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes, and seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is an empty chair. Justice Bablish usually sits in, and he will be participating, but unfortunately is not able to be here this afternoon in person. And on the right of the empty chair is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to the far right is David Prosser. With the introductions made, I'll now call the last case for today, which is 01-3063-CR, State versus Picotti. And representing Mr. Picotti is John, and is it Wasilewski?
Wasilewski.
I wasn't even close. Thank you, counsel. And representing the state of Wisconsin will be Assistant Attorney General David J. Becker. Counsel.
May it please the court. As the court's indicated, I'm John Wasilewski, appearing for Mr. Picotti. We're all here today, at least initially, because in September of 1996 there was a fight outside a bar. This didn't result in anyone dying immediately. There was no homicide because there was no death. It did, however, result for Mr. Picotti in conviction for two felony batteries for which he received an aggregate sentence of 15 years. Almost 3 years later, in June of 1999, one of the two battery victims did die. And as a result, Mr. Picotti faced a reckless homicide charge. He went to trial. He was convicted. And he received a 30-year concurrent sentence. Mr. Picotti's case then went to the late Howard Eisenberg, my predecessor in this appeal and to whom I'm indebted. He pointed out in post-conviction proceedings the existence of the year and a day rule, and he found out the reason it had never come up prior to post-conviction proceedings was simply because trial counsel failed to raise it out of ignorance. The year and a day rule has been around, though, for about 800 years. The state concedes it. According to that rule, there can be no homicide based on a death that occurred more than a year and a day after the incident giving rise to the injuries. So if the court affirms that rule today, Mr. Picot's homicide conviction cannot stand. I argue first that this court may not abrogate this rule, and I cite as grounds for that the Wisconsin Constitution, and specifically Article 14, Section 13. This section incorporates into Wisconsin's law the common law as it existed when Wisconsin was a territory. And what that basically means, and what cases have construed it to mean, is that the common law of England prior to the Revolutionary War came in to become the territorial law initially, and then the law of the state of Wisconsin upon statehood. But the crucial phase is that that law, that common law, shall continue until altered or suspended by the legislature. I think the cleaner meaning of that is that the legislature is the body that in the first and final instance should be the one to consider whether this 800-year rule is ripe for reevaluation, is ripe for abrogation.
How do you get around some of our case law, cases like State versus Esser, State versus Hobson? In Esser, basically, we talked about the fact that the courts do have the authority to abrogate such rules, and in State versus Hobson, we did abrogate such a rule. Yes. Now, it seems to me that those cases are pretty clear that we do have the authority to abrogate a rule, even if it's 800 years old, if it's a rule that no longer makes any sense and has no longer real justification.
The line of cases does begin with Esser, and that is the line of cases I have asked this court to consider, to reconsider. And if the court does not choose to do that, I nonetheless will be asking the court, not in this case, to abrogate the rule, but I'll address Esser first. Esser concerned the insanity defense, and the court in Esser did look back to the ancient common law at some length, and the court found basically two things. Yes, there's a common law insanity defense, but more importantly to the decision in that case, the particular test to be applied wasn't settled in pre-revolutionary English common law. Therefore, the court very simply could have said, we can't tell what the common law rule must be. There is no single definition of insanity we could pick from among several, or we can write on a clean slate because there's no agreed upon settled common law rule defining insanity. But instead, the court in Esser went on and announced that they could change the common law. And I believe that that was unnecessary. It was dicta in the case, but it's what led to the line of cases culminating most recently in Hobson.
Counsel, this comes to mind. A lot of our provisions in the Constitution, in our state Constitution, are really borrowed from New York. Do you know what the New York court did, if anything, on the year and day rule? Does their Constitution have the same provision? Any idea?
I do not know, Your Honor. I would be happy to submit a supplemental memorandum on that question.
When I say, does their Constitution, I mean, does their Constitution have the same constitutional language as is before the court today?
I do not know.
Thank you.
One thing that sets this case apart from Esser is that the legislature was not completely ignorant of this rule, as demonstrated by activity in the legislature in the 1950s. As I outlined in my brief there, the legislature actually enacted a provision to repeal the rule but also provided that this would have to be reenacted in the subsequent legislature to take effect, and that simply never happened. I think the court can draw two conclusions from this. The first one is the obvious one. Clearly, the legislature recognized that the rule exists in Wisconsin. But more importantly, the legislature declined to act. And I think that should give this court pause before stepping in where the legislature declined to. This is different from some of the cases cited by the state where insurance and liability issues were dealt with by this court despite the legislature declining to have done so. This is a criminal case where a person's liberty is at stake, and I don't think that there's any case in this state where this court has abrogated a rule after the legislature declined to abrogate it in a criminal context.
Well, if we accept that argument, then any single legislator could introduce a bill in which the bill would attempt to change the common law or affirm the common law, and the legislature doesn't pass it. That would bind this court's hands to the common law as of 1848. How can that be right?
I don't think the court has to go that far when they look at what the legislature does. I think here we've had at least an instance where the full legislature passed a bill, including this, at least provisionally. They didn't pass it a second time, but this isn't a matter of one legislator acting. This is a matter of the majority voting, at least in one occasion, for it. Legislative history is, of course, slippery. It runs the gamut from casual comments about legislation to very detailed investigations.
Did the legislature take it out, or did the advisory committee take it out?
Well, according to the article by Mr. Platts that's cited in my brief, it was done for policy reasons. It doesn't say specifically by whom, but it was removed for policy reasons, so it wasn't just a casual oversight. And again, that begs the question, since the state is asking this court for policy reasons to abrogate the rule.
Does it make a difference? I think your opposing counsel indicates that the committee took it out rather than it being before the legislature. Does it make a difference in your argument if it's the committee that took it out before the 1955 legislation as opposed to the legislature?
No, because I think the initial legislative history I'm pointing to here that shows that they considered it is that the whole legislature passed a bill incorporating the rescission, and that way this court can look at what the legislature as a whole expressed as an opinion rather than as a committee. We can only speculate what the legislature would have done had the committee left it in for consideration in that second round and whether they would have reenacted it as part of the total package or not. Obviously, since that path was cut off by the committee, we'll never know. If this court decides to consider policy, to consider the 800-year history of this rule, I think the court should also note that it's very easy to claim, and I would have a hard time disputing, that medical science in 2002 is much further advanced than it was in the 1300s. But there's really nothing on this record to base that on other than citations to other appellate courts that have so concluded. And that, again, begs the question, which body is best suited to reevaluate this? Which body is best situated to evaluate the current state of medical science, and specifically with regard to determining times of death or causes of death? There's simply not the record here to do that other than to say, well, everybody knows we're much more advanced now. I ask this court not to abrogate the rule, but I also ask it especially not to abrogate it retroactively. In 1996, when this bar fight happened, the law of Wisconsin was no death unless it, no homicide unless death occurs within a year and a day. The death here happened nearly 3 years later, which again begs another question. Some states haven't abrogated this rule entirely, they've modified it. California, for example, has a 3 year and a day rule. Why not a 2 year and a day rule? Where do you draw that line? The line drawing process sounds of a legislative quality, and that's another reason I ask this court not to abrogate the rule.
Well, counsel, if we were going to abrogate it, I find it perhaps the most troublesome issue in the case is the retroactivity. I'm not sure that I understand completely what the rules are on retroactivity. When you apply something retroactively and you do not, there's a violation of due process, and perhaps you can explain that to me.
Your Honor, everyone fundamentally has a right to know, or at least to be able to go and look up what the law is, what the law requires, what it doesn't require. In 1996, at the time of the bar fight, the law of Wisconsin, and I think the state concedes this by conceding that the year and a day rule is part of Wisconsin's common law. The rule was, if you commit an act that does not result in a death within a year and a day, you have not committed a homicide. What the state's asking this court to do by applying the rule, by abrogating the rule and applying the abrogation retroactively, is to change the substantive criminal law in 2002 based on an act done in 1996 and a result that occurred from the act in 1999. That violates fundamental fairness, Judge. There is no way around seeing what the law was in 1996 or 1999, either way, as including the year and a day rule as a requirement, as an element of homicide. The Rogers case, which is a hotly contested 5-4 United States Supreme Court decision, does not control this court's decision with respect to the state constitutional due process issue. That addresses only the federal issue.
Counsel, don't we normally draw upon the U.S. Supreme Court and look to the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court in areas of criminal law and areas of constitutional rights? And you're mentioning Rogers versus Tennessee. That's a case where I think the U.S. Supreme Court was very clear that when the Tennessee Supreme Court did what we're being asked to do here, abrogate the rule, that there was no violation of ex post facto prohibitions and there was no violation of due process. Why should this court ignore literally that decision and that finding that there was no violation of fundamental fairness there? Why would there be a violation here?
Well, Justice O'Connor, in the Rogers decision, first off, found the connection, even the existence of the rule under Tennessee law to be very tenuous. In Wisconsin, on the other hand, we do have the constitutional provision that specifically incorporates the common law, and I think that gives Mr. Picotte greater reason to rely on that common law, and it distinguishes Rogers from this case. This case, also, aside from Rogers, this court's most recent, the Hobson case, the most recent incident where the court abrogated a common law rule, in that case, based on both federal and state constitutional grounds, this court did not abrogate. In that case, it was a defense of resisting an unlawful arrest. The court did not abrogate that defense retroactively, but only prospectively, citing both constitutions. Therefore, the court has reached a fork in the road. This court can follow Rogers case and simply adopt that reasoning, or this court can follow its own reasoning in Hobson and say the path we've laid there for constitutional law in, under Wisconsin's constitution does not require our abrogation or does not justify it. There's no precedent in Wisconsin for retroactively applying a new definition of crime to past conduct. This court would be taking a bold step out of its prior precedent. So the relief I'm requesting is to either reaffirm the rule, or in the event this court chooses to abrogate it, to apply the abrogation only prospectively, to grant Mr. Picote the relief he requests, which is dismissal of the homicide charge with an order that the credit for the time served on this case be applied to the battery conviction resulting out of the same incident.
Counsel, I want to focus on your distinction of the Rogers versus Tennessee case. As I recall the analysis in that case, one of the three elements considered by the court was the foothold, if you will, that the year and a day law had in the jurisprudence of the state of Tennessee. And it indicated that the foothold that this common law doctrine had in Tennessee was tenuous. It seems to me that the foothold is even less here in Wisconsin. As I recall, there was reference to this in some, was it 1848 or 1847 opinion, and then also recently referenced in a 2002 opinion. Court of Appeals opinion. Again, it may have been in a footnote. It's not much of a foothold, and it seems to be even less than that which was found in Tennessee. Can you respond to that?
Well, I would respond in two ways. One I think I've already addressed, which is in Wisconsin, unlike anything mentioned in the Rogers case, the common law, whether frequently cited, rarely cited, or perhaps even never cited, has been incorporated by state constitutional provision into the law of this state. In Tennessee, for all I can tell from that decision, the court wasn't bound to say this is the law of Tennessee, at least not by their state constitution. But more importantly, you get into a question of validity of a law because of the happenstance of how frequently it applies. And I think it's a fairly rare factual situation where a person dies more than a year after an incident that's attributed to be the cause of the death, and therefore a rare situation that this comes up. And unfortunately for Mr. Picote, he's the rare instance, and I don't think that should affect the validity of the law, in particular tying back to that constitutional provision that brings it in. But I do think that the constitutional provision makes it less tenuous than Tennessee's. Thank you.
You also make some argument that, as you previously did, that in California, it was modified. Now it's 3 years in a day. If I recall, there's a couple of jurisdictions you reference in your brief that have declined to change this rule. Judicially, they say if it's going to be done, the legislature should do it. I don't have those at my fingertips. Perhaps you could edify me with reminding me what those two jurisdictions are and also advising me whether or not those jurisdictions had similar constitutional provisions.
My recollection of that being brought up is that it is actually in the state's brief and that the state pointed out that those decisions were based primarily on the notion of deference to the legislature, which is what I'm asking this court to do, and not based on an evaluation of the policy followed by a conclusion that we're not going to abrogate.
My prior question here this afternoon also hinted at the idea of what other states have this a similar constitutional provision, do you know?
No, I feel foolish now because I, quite frankly, was assuming it was a rather unique provision without having checked to see if that's the case.
Well, it's rather bizarre, but I'm not sure it's rather unique. So.
And I guess based on my assumption, I never looked into it.
Well, we can check it, at least as of 1962, and then check it from there. There's an index digest to state constitutions as of 1962, published by Columbia University.
If the court would grant me leave, I'd be happy to file a memo.
Look it up.
Thank you.
What's troublesome to me here is my understanding of common law is, at least by and large, it is court-made law. Court-made law in England. Court-made law in England close to 250 years ago, maybe 800 years ago. It seems to me an unusual proposition to be asking this court to say that we cannot change court-made law in this state unless the legislature acts.
Well, the law has been traced, and I believe it's cited in both of our briefs, actually to something called the Statute of Gloucester. I don't know enough about ancient English law to tell what exactly that root is, but in any event, our Constitution did adopt it, despite the fact that it's, in some case, adopting very ancient law. But one thing I think makes this different from typical common law analysis is that this court is not being asked by the state to simply take this rule and see how does it apply. Is there a question about the time of death? Is there a question about whether there was brain death versus the heartbeat having stopped? This isn't applying a law to a new and novel fact situation. This state's asking this court to simply wipe the slate clean, to make the law completely opposite to what it has been. I don't think that's really traditional common law jurisprudence to do that.
Well, certainly you wouldn't argue that Mr. Picot relied on this 800-year-old law when he was beating Mr. Jackson, would you?
At that time, perhaps no, but another scenario might have been, had I been Mr. Picot's lawyer in 1997, a year and 2 days after the incident, if he had asked me, can I be prosecuted if this man dies? My answer would have been, if I'd done my research as I'd done in this brief, no, the year and the day rule would protect you. And the state's asking this court to retroactively take away that protection.
You're supposed to know the law, right? I mean, that's the legal fiction that everybody knows the law. You have no defense. You don't know the law.
I think what you're saying is ignorance of the law is no defense.
Something like that.
Usually no excuse.
So whether he knows or not, he should only be punished. He may not know a lot of laws, but he'll be punished if he violates them, intentionally doing an act. Right.
Right. But there was no way he could protect himself. There was no precaution he could have taken such that he could know that if he gets into an altercation resulting in a death more than a year and a day later, he'd be charged with homicide. I guess it is a fiction to say that we could, that any person can know everything in those five volumes of the Wisconsin statutes over there, which is only a small fraction of the law. But you should at least be able to ascertain what it is and rely on that as being what the law is at a point in time, and rely on the notion that it won't be changed in the future retroactively. I see my warning lights on here, so I will...
Well, you have 5 more minutes, and then you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, but you don't have to feel you have to use all your time, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Becker. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I appear here this afternoon on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, the plaintiff respondent in this case. I think I've said everything that needs to be said in my brief. I suspect the court may have some questions, and maybe I can just briefly highlight the state's position, and as we reach issues that this court has questions about, the court can interject them. First of all, as we point out in our brief, there is no dispute between the parties that the year and a day rule exists in Wisconsin as a common law rule preserved by that provision of the state constitution, which provides that common law rules are preserved until they're altered or suspended, I think is the word, by the legislature.
Is that the law of the state today?
Is it the law today? I'm not sure exactly how to answer that, because what I'm going to ask you to declare in your decision is that that rule is abrogated, and I'm going to ask you to do what the Tennessee Supreme Court did and was found to be constitutional by the United States Supreme Court. I'm going to ask you to abrogate that decision retroactively so that it applies to Mr. Picot and anyone else who may be in Mr. Picot's position that committed crimes in the past and the victim did not die within a year and a day. So I guess the answer to your question turns on what your decision ultimately is in this case. If you do what the state is requesting, that is abrogate the rule and abrogate it retroactively, then I can at that point come in and answer your question and say no, the rule didn't exist in Wisconsin on December 5th, if that's what today is, 2002, because we've abrogated the rule and we've abrogated it for all cases, and that we've abrogated retroactively for all cases in the past, so that it wasn't in effect for a person who committed a crime on December 5th, 2002, or earlier. That's the best answer I can give to that question.
Is Article 14, Section 13 still in effect?
Boy, I sure hope so. I'm going to look the fool. It's still in our Constitution, yes. I don't think
that's right. So if it's still in our Constitution and it says the common law exists as of when the Constitution was adopted and it only should be changed by the legislature, then it seems to me your argument is violating the very plain language of that constitutional amendment.
Well,
the
main answer to that, I think, is that I think it's just simply too late to take that position. I mean, this court has made it as clear as it possibly could that it does not view that provision as barring it from changing the common law. And it went into a lengthy discussion of that whole issue in Esser, explained why it didn't feel barred. To me, the most critical aspect of that discussion is that common law, by its inherent nature, is law that can be changed by the courts, as I think one of the justices suggested was the case. And so that what is preserved is our rules of law that are always subject to this court's modification, abrogation, or affirmance, for that matter. And
that's consistent with the constitutional provision?
I think it's absolutely consistent. As I said in my brief, as long as you understand what the nature of the common law is that can't be altered or suspended, i.e. law that the legislature that the courts retain the right to modify and abrogate, and if that's then what's preserved, then that obviously, as said in ESSER, it didn't say that the provision explicitly gives you that power, but that power is implicitly there by virtue of the nature of common law.
What does that provision mean?
It means, just as what you said in ESSER, that the constitutional provision reads such parts of the common law as are now enforced in the territory of Wisconsin, not inconsistent with this constitution, shall be and continue part of the law of the state until all, and then I'll add a word here, consistent with your ESSER decision, explicitly until altered or suspended by the legislature, or implicitly until the courts alter or abrogate.
You read in a lot of stuff.
This court wrote in a lot of stuff. That's precisely what ESSER says.
Did we goof?
You did not goof. As I said, you didn't goof because what you recognized was the inherent nature of the common law. The common law is by its nature law that is subject to modification and abrogation by the courts. That's what's preserved until altered or suspended by the legislature.
So could the legislature say tomorrow, don't develop the common law anymore, which is taking it as of ESSER or as of today? Constitution.
Are you saying, no, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Suppose the legislature adopts a law saying no more common law development of anything that was common law as of 1848, and anything, the court has done up until today, all right, under ESSA, but no more, and we're exercising our power under Article 14, Section 13.
I think the bottom line answer is I don't think the legislature could do that, but boy, I think that may well be a separation of powers problem. I don't know. You've caught me on something. I don't think this case. You're asking me to speculate about what the legislature could do. I don't think this case about
turns out. Figure out what this constitutional provision really means. I mean, I know what ESSER said, but I don't know what it means. If that's, we've read it out of the Constitution, then. Can do anything.
No, you haven't read it out of the Constitution because until either under the explicit power granted by that provision the legislature acts, or until the implicit power recognized in ESSER that this court has, and until therefore this court acts, the common law rules continue. We're applying, well, I don't know if I got any examples outside of my head, but there are common law rules, I think, being applied probably in courts every in the state all the time, and this court is, I think, probably applying common law rules in its decisions on a regular basis. Like I say, don't ask me to give you some examples here off the top of my head, but I'm sure that's happening. And that's what this provision means, is that you, until you decide to abrogate them, they are the rules, and you can invoke those rules in your decision-making process, you and the Court of Appeals and the trial courts of this state. That's what that provision means. It hasn't been written out of the Constitution by ESSER. It still has that effect.
Maybe alienation of affection is a good example.
See, now you're outside the criminal law.
Expert. I apologize.
In any case, we got into then the second point here. As I said, we're all in agreement that the rule is preserved by a constitutional provision. We have now moved on to the second question then, where the parties start to diverge, and that is, does this court have the power to abrogate the rule? I've just stated our position with regard to that. ESSER makes that absolutely clear. I have in my brief given you a string set of cases since ESSER that have either quoted directly from ESSER on that proposition or have restated that proposition in different language, right on up to Hobson, where this court in the criminal law context with respect to criminal liability not only found that it had the power to abrogate the rule and, in fact, invoked ESSER for that proposition, but then proceeded to abrogate the common law rule. So,
Mr. Becker, why shouldn't we follow Hobson all the way then? Why shouldn't we take the position that, okay, we're going to abrogate the rule, we're going to accept what you want us to do here, but we're going to make it prospective, not retroactive? That's what we did in Hobson.
That's right. And with all due respect, you were wrong in Hobson. I interpret Hobson, I don't think it can be read any other way, as your conclusion that you were bound by the Constitution not to apply it retroactively. We now know, as a result of a post-Hobson decision, namely the Rogers decision, that that is not correct. You adopted a view of the due process. First of all, we know, in terms of constitutional restrictions, we know that the ex post facto clause is not directly binding here because that only applies to legislative enactments. So the question is due process violated? And I think that Hobson and its reliance on the earlier decision, and I never know how to pronounce this case, Kurtzawa, or whatever, however it's pronounced, I think that it seems to suggest, Hobson, and with its reliance on that earlier decision, seems to suggest that this court was of the view that you basically take the ex post facto principles and you turn them into principles of due process. And so whatever would be barred, whatever the legislature would be barred from doing by virtue of the ex post facto clause, this court would be barred, or the courts would be barred from doing by virtue of the due process clause. That was expressly and specifically confronted in Rogers and rejected. So I think the bottom line simply is our position is that you were wrong, and I say that with all due respect, that you were wrong in Hobson. You didn't, whether on the basis of the development of the law up to that point or not, you should have gone that way or not, that's water over the dam. The fact is, now we know as a result of Rogers that you were definitely wrong insofar as that's what you were concluding, and I think that's what you were concluding, that you were bound, that you could not constitutionally apply it retroactively. Rogers says you definitely can.
Well, if you look at Hobson, and Part 5 deals with the prospective application of abrogation, there's a citation to both the federal and state constitutions, and there are citations to state and federal court decisions. We cited Blensky, cited Kurzawa, and cited Thiel, and cited U.S. Supreme Court Beazle, and I guess it's one of the U.S. Supreme Court cases. I'd have to go back and read all of those to see if they're both on the state and federal, but you got a lot of state court citations there where we thought about it in terms of our own law.
I think not. Again, with all due respect.
Respect taken.
Blinsky is cited in footnote 24, talking about who has the burden of approving affirmative defense. So that has nothing to do with this. The two state constitutional provisions are the two ex post facto provisions. I don't think my opponent disagrees, and in fact I think he explicitly concedes in his initial brief that ex post facto does not apply here because that is limited to legislative judgment.
Said otherwise. We said this principle of due process applies also to law arising from judicial decisions.
Yes, and that's where you
can the Kurzawa.
Exactly. And that's where I think you made your mistake. And now if you're suggesting that you didn't make a mistake because you were basing it on the state constitution and not on the federal constitution, then what I ask you to do is turn to State versus Kurzawa, 180 West 2nd 502 at pages 510, 511, which you cited there. And if you look at those two pages, You will not find a single Wisconsin decision. You will not find any reference to the Wisconsin Constitution. The discussion starts in the bottom of page 510, ends at the bottom of page 511, and it cites Marx versus the United States Supreme Court decision, Bowie versus City of Columbia, United States Supreme Court decision, Wiesel versus Ohio, that same one that I think we just saw in the Hobson decision, United States Supreme Court decision, and Collins versus Youngblood, a United States Supreme Court decision. It's absolutely plain that you were not basing Hobson on any independent interpretation of the state constitution. And were you to do that, you would be departing dramatically from the tack you have taken in the past with regard to the due process clauses of the state and federal constitutions, or the due process clause of the state constitution, I should say. You have over and over again said that we will conform our understanding of the state due process provision to the interpretation has been given to the federal provision.
I think that it's more accurate to say that ordinarily the two are interpreted the same. That's our usual statement.
I think you've stated it more strongly in some cases.
In some cases.
Although it has often been hedged, because like you say, ordinarily, sometimes the language is substantially equivalent, leaving a little bit of wiggle room. But the point still stands. Given that as the legal backdrop, that you have ordinarily done that, or you have found those two provisions to be substantially equivalent, you cannot possibly read Hobson and its reference to Kurosawa and what Kurosawa relied on. You can't possibly find that you were coming up with an independent interpretation of the state due process clause when you decided that Hobson, that the abrogation of the common law rule at issue in Hobson shouldn't be applied retroactively to Hobson.
What about the argument made that Tennessee did not have Article 14, Section 13 in it, and that therefore you don't have a presumption in Tennessee that the common law as of 1848 applies? And you don't have any Wisconsin case law as of 2002, December, what's today's date, 6th?
I was off earlier when I said 5th, I guess. I don't know. I lost track of that.
6th,
okay.
So as of December 6th, you don't have any law in Wisconsin that says it's not 1 year and 1 day. In fact, the law as of this minute is 1 year, 1 day.
That's the long answer I gave earlier.
You don't know until you decide.
I don't know until you decide the case.
Okay, so as of today, it's 1 year, 1 day. With it being challenged.
I'll have to concede that, I guess. Just as I don't want to concede it in such a way that it knocks out my retroactivity rule.
I understand that.
Yeah, okay. Just as long. The answer, I think, is this. Given the fact, as we pointed out earlier, that the constitutional provision does not bar this court from modifying or abrogating common law rules, I find it very difficult to find a distinction between the situation in Tennessee and the situation in Wisconsin. In both situations, they clearly recognized that they had a common law rule. There had been an argument made. In fact, the Court of Appeals in Tennessee had adopted the argument that the common law rule had been abrogated by the legislature. The Tennessee. And abrogated the rule, so the rule continues. And it seems to me that given the nature of the Wisconsin constitutional revision, which interpreted in Esser and Hobson and all the other cases, permits courts to continue to modify, refine, and abrogate the common law rule, I can't find a real substantive difference between the situation in Tennessee and the situation here.
Suppose we had a statute that said it's murder if the person lives less than 1 year and 1 day. Okay. Or the other way, person lives beyond 1 year, 1 day, it is not a homicide.
Okay. In other words, if we codified the year and a day rule.
Yeah, statutory. Okay.
Right.
Then Mr. Picotti acts, right? As what date was that? 1996.
Okay, September.
So in 1996, when he acted, the state had that statute, 1 year, 1 day. As of December 6, 2002, well, let's take it yesterday, the statute is changed, and it's totally repealed, or maybe it's a 10-year statute, is now put in. All right. And the defendant says, hey, you can't apply that statute to me, because the basic concepts of due process is that on the date of conduct, there was a law that prohibited, as a matter of criminal law, prohibited that conduct. And as of the 1997 Act, there was no such law. And you cannot retroactively make that a law.
And that
right?
defendant
And
would,
what would you say?
I would say, Mr. Defendant, you are absolutely 100% correct.
I thought you'd say.
How could I take any other position? Because you're talking about legislative enactments that are subject to the ex post facto clause. And what you have described is an attempt to apply a legislative enactment in a fashion that violates the ex post facto clause.
Okay. I've just forgotten at the moment. Does ex post facto apply to the states through due process?
Well, in the same sense that, well, sure, in the same sense that all of those protections,
right.
but it applies in all its force and vigor as the ex post facto clause. It does not apply as final or you know as.
What kind of sense does it make in law to say it is a violation of your constitutional rights, basic due process, fairness, through the ex post? Post facto, if the legislature does it, but that this court sitting here can do it, and it's A-okay. I mean, how does that make any sense? Theoretically, the legislative change of law should have more, it's the public policy making branch, it makes the law, we only interpret the law incrementally, right?
Correct, and I think that precise issue, or very close to it, was specifically addressed by the court in Rogers, because both the defendant and the dissent in Rogers made only a slightly different argument from the one you made. They asked whether or not if the legislature abrogated the common law rule, would they be violating the ex post facto clause? Defendant in that case and the dissent said that if the legislature had abrogated the year and a day rule, that would be barred by ex post facto principles, but the court could do it, but the court found that it could do it without violating due process. And the court gave a couple of responses, and I'm not sure I can do complete justice to them, and I encourage you to read that section of the.
I didn't understand it.
Well, I think the simple.
Neither did four members of that court dig it.
That's true, and I will say this: the one thing that I think is very understandable is this, and I think it's their primary response. In that, the primary response of the court in Rogers was, it's the system we have that the ex post facto clause only applies to legislative enactments, and everybody is in agreement on that. And once you move over into the due process clause, due process does not necessarily require that all ex post facto principles be carried over in all their strength and vigor, because ex post facto, I think my opponent was onto something here when he talked about fundamental fairness and a violation of fundamental fairness. That's what due process protects. The ex post facto clause goes beyond fundamental fairness. Or can go beyond fundamental fairness in a given case, and it is there's nothing fundamentally unfair. You know what the Rogers case held is that I don't think they used the fundamental unfairness. They talked about whether or not the abrogation was indefensible in light of and indefensible and unexpected in light of the state of the law at the time. The court found that the Supreme Court in Rogers found that there was no due process violation, and if you want to label it fundamental fairness, label it that way, if in fact the defendant's reliance on the common law rule was not fully justified, and that he had to realize that if he tried to invoke that rule, that it was likely that it was going to be struck down, as the Tennessee court did, and as I'm asking this court to do, and as so many courts have done, which is what puts a defendant on notice, that he can't really justifiably rely on that rule, given the state of the law in the country, the very tenuous foothold that the year-to-day rule has in Wisconsin, where it has only been mentioned in a territorial decision prior to 1848, and there only in a description of the trial court's decision, not even mentioned in the court's actual opinion, and then just recently mentioned for the first time since statehood in a footnote which simply describes it and says, and the rule has been abolished in the majority of jurisdictions. Anybody reading that certainly is put on notice that this is not a rule that is likely to receive approval by this court when this court is finally confronted with the question as to whether or not it should be should exist or not in this state.
Let's say I'm a criminal defendant, and the question of due process turns on whether the abrogation was unexpected. So here I am. Boy, I got this year and a day rule. Now, it's been in effect for 800 years. That's a bit of a pedigree. There is a constitutional provision. Our hallowed constitution has a provision that makes it the law of the state. That law was in effect at the time I committed my act. That law was in effect 3 years later at the time of the death. That law is in effect as I am talking right now. Isn't the abrogation a bit unexpected if 2 months from now this court comes out with an opinion that says, I don't care if it was effect at the time of the act or the death or for 800 years, or I don't care that you have a specific constitutional provision that incorporates it, we're abrogating it. I mean, isn't there an argument that that's unexpected? Can't people not only rely on precedent, but rely on 800-year precedent?
Well, let me say, first of all, the U.S. Supreme Court obviously did not think it's unexpected for a court to do that. And I think that they were absolutely right. I mean, is it...
But they didn't have the same constitutional provision that we
had. Well, but and that gets us back to I don't think it makes any difference, because the state of the common law rule in Tennessee was exactly the state of the common law rule in Wisconsin. Namely, there's no question everybody agreed that it existed. It hadn't been abrogated by the legislature, and given what Esser and its progeny teach us about the constitutional provision in Wisconsin, we know that it exists only so long as this court deems it to exist, and that this court has the power to abrogate it. And anybody looking at the year, if there ever was a common law rule in the criminal law that makes absolutely no sense, it's the year and a day rule. I mean, and I don't think my opponent. I don't think he's ever argued. I can't remember his whole argument here this afternoon. I know in his brief, I don't think he ever argues on the merits that this rule deserves to be retained. He fights over who can abolish it, whether it's limited to the legislature. He fights over whether it should be retroactively abolished. or not, but I don't think he's offered any reasons. He certainly didn't in his brief offer any reasons why on its merits it should be retained. And the reason, I think, being is it's inconceivable that there are any reasons. Nobody, the thought wouldn't even cross anybody's mind today to create such a rule. It would be absolutely ludicrous. We have the defendant fully protected by the requirement that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the cause of death. There's absolutely no question that medicine today has an ability to determine the cause of death, of deaths that have occurred long after the fatal blow was struck. This, like I say, wouldn't even cross someone's mind, and if it did, it would be immediately put out of their mind to create a rule along these lines. So I think in that kind of a situation, it is not at all unexpected or indefensible to, unexpected was your question. It is not unexpected that when the court is finally given the opportunity, or the court system, because I think if this had been raised in the trial court could have said, in exercising my common law, exercising my judging function, I don't think that this rule makes any sense, and I'm abrogating it and take it up through the appellate courts and see if they agree. In any case, no one can't justifiably expect that the courts, when finally given the opportunity to do so, would not do what the state is asking this court to do this afternoon, and that is abrogate the rule, because there are no justifications for the rule to continue. And if anything, there are developments that affirmatively say it's a bad rule, namely the developments in life support systems and life sustaining systems. The thought that we're going to require people to decide, whether to disconnect a person from life support, and have hanging over that decision possibly the fact that if you don't do it before a year and a day is up, the fellow that just murdered your loved one is going to walk away from any murder charge.
Mr. Becker.
Yeah.
And that's a very good and important public policy. And that's why probably legislatures and judiciaries across the country have abrogated or repealed or this rule. And there's also no question that striking somebody and causing, whether it's coma or death or some other awful effect, is criminal and should be punished. No one disputes any of that. The issue for the court today is what kind of system of law we want to provide fairness. Not what we want, but what's been set forth in the state constitution and the federal constitution, so that what happens is fair for everybody. Because the next person may be, that is within the criminal law web, may be any of us, right?
Correct.
So we want a process that protects everybody. And one of the rules is that this court cannot define a crime. We can't establish what's criminal conduct, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So why, if we move from 1 year and 1 day to a larger time period, aren't we establishing a crime? Because it was not a crime in 97, not the crime of homicide. It was a crime. And now it's going to be the crime of homicide. So why, if we change that rule, isn't the court, contrary to everything we've all been taught, establishing a new crime?
I see my red light is on, and I'll try and answer that question as briefly as I can. But I think all I can do is repeat what I said earlier, which is that I'm not sure it was. It was only not a crime, insofar as we can say it was not a crime. It was only not a crime by virtue of a common law rule. It's a common law rule that the courts have the power to abrogate, and it's a common law rule that under Rogers versus Tennessee, the courts have the power to abrogate retroactively. And given that that's the reason it wasn't a crime, It's not that it wasn't a crime because the legislature hadn't proscribed his conduct, or because this court's decisions hadn't indicated that it was his conduct. But if it's only not a crime back then because of a common law rule subject to judicial abrogation and which can constitutionally be applied retroactively, which abrogation of the rule can constitutionally be applied retroactively, then I don't find anything at all indefensible in going back and saying to this fellow, you're out of luck. You're relying on a rule that probably hasn't made sense for hundreds of years, certainly didn't make sense on the day you committed your crime, and we're simply not going to allow you to escape punishment for the crime you committed by virtue of the invocation of that rule.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Thank you.
Becker, could you go back retroactively? Or how far could you go back retroactively?
I believe you could go back retroactively to any case that's in front of you. Which as a practical matter means that it would only be a matter of the lifetimes of presently living human beings. But what you're simply doing with retroactivity is you're not setting dates or anything like that. All you're saying is we're applying it to this fellow. This may be as far back as you ever go, because there may not be any other cases in the pipeline now where this is the situation.
But look, there is no statute of limitations on murder, is there?
No.
Okay. So you have somebody sitting in prison now, and I don't know if this is Justice Brass's question. You have somebody sitting in prison now who, 10 years ago, or 5, you can pick the time, struck somebody. That person did not die until 2 years later after the criminal conduct. Everybody relying on the 1 year, one day, just...
Unjustifiable reliance.
That's your position, and I'll accept that for the moment. But relied on the 1 year, one day, prisoned him for a serious battery and any other offenses he committed. He's now sitting in prison. Why can't the DA now prosecute him for homicide? I don't know if that's Justice Process.
Yeah, he
it
can.
It is Justice Process. So he can.
He can.
And so it's retroactive. As long as somebody is alive, it was a defendant.
That's the point I was trying to make when I said we're kind of limited the lifetimes of people presently living. But
and you don't even have to be in prison. You could have served your time on the battery and been out now, and you can still be charged. Under your theory.
As long as the state can sustain its burden of proof.
Absolutely.
That there was a cause and effect relationship between that man's act and that victim's death. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel?
Thank you. Mr. Becker asked what arguments I've raised why this rule should be retained, and he's right. In my brief, I really didn't raise such arguments. I felt it was a little awkward to argue this court isn't the one that should decide whether the appropriate policy would be to abrogate the rule or not. But that doesn't mean such reasons don't exist, and I would cite one that I mentioned in my earlier presentation, which is that California, by statute, retained the rule in a modified form. They made it 3 years and a day. I think that flies in the face of Mr. Becker's assertion that no one would ever have such a rule. I'd also cite the Stevenson case, a Michigan case that's mentioned in the brief, and in particular there's a concurrence there, or I'm not sure if it's a concurring opinion or a dissenting opinion, where some policy reasons favoring the rule are laid out, and they basically make an analogy, I think, to statute of limitations, that at some point there should be reached a point of repose, that if a person, for example, inflicts an injury on a very young person, and then that person dies as a very old person, then there's no legal impediment to charging, attributing the death criminally, even if it happened 10, 20, 30 years later. There's nothing to prevent the charge from coming. Of course, as Mr. Becker indicates, the state would have to meet its burden of proof as to causation. But that doesn't really give a defendant a feeling of repose that they are free from being charged for a death that may have happened decades earlier. So the rule is not without logic and without reason. I'm asking the court not to abrogate the rule, but if it reaches the point where the question is only to abrogate either prospectively or retroactively, I think the real decision of this court is going to be whether to follow the United States Supreme Court in that most recent decision in Rogers versus Tennessee.
Counsel, and in that regard, I'm looking at, I don't know if it's Stevens, one of the, that in that case, and the opinion is saying, it's one of the dissenting opinions, I don't know. I know Scalia wrote. At any rate, it says, finally, the court seeks to establish, the majority seeks to establish fair warning by discussing at length how unclear it was that the year and a day rule was ever the law in Tennessee. What's your reading of the majority opinion in Roberts versus Tennessee? Are they saying that it's well established in Tennessee or that it's unclear that...
I think Justice O'Connor, who wrote the majority, thought that it, I think her words were that the rule had a very tenuous hold in Tennessee law. Now, Justice Scalia says in his dissent, well, the Supreme Court of Tennessee said that's the law in Tennessee. The year and day rule is the law, but I don't think that you can... I think you have to view the majority opinion as being based, at least in part, on the tenuous hold that the rule, the year-and-a-day rule, had in Tennessee law, at least according in the opinion of the writers of the majority opinion.
You've argued that the distinction here is the constitutional provision, right?
State constitutional provision.
Is it your argument on retroactivity that that state constitutional provision essentially confers an individual right? Because I would imagine that has quite broad implications.
Well, certainly, I think if it's in the Constitution that the laws of England were brought into this country as the law of the land until abrogated by the legislature, certainly if you can't rely on that as a citizen, it becomes meaningless. I do believe it creates rights in that regard, yes.
It creates an individual right to the common law as it existed in 1848.
To the protections of the common law to the extent that the legislature hasn't suspended or abrogated them.
Well, assuming we get over that part of it and say that the court retains the authority to alter the common law, that would have very broad implications for retroactivity analysis across the board, it seems to me, and that no decision that constitutes any alteration of the common law whatsoever can be applied to the case at hand. You see what I'm saying? Maybe I'm not being clear. If this constitutional provision confers an individual right to the common law as it existed in 1848, then any decision we make on any issue of common law, whether it's tort law or contract law or anything else, cannot be applied to the particular case in which the rule, the new rule of common law is made. No? If we accept your view.
I'm not sure I follow you, granting that the you've brought into tort law and all these other possible implications beyond my
Mr.
practice
Becker's
here.
Standard
I'm a criminal defense lawyer pretty much exclusively. But at least in a criminal context, where a person's liberty is at stake, if the common law provided a protection, I think the article of Wisconsin's Constitution incorporating that common law is something a citizen should be able to rely on in defense in a criminal action. If I may make one concluding statement that I started to make, I think if this court decides to abrogate the rule and is only considering prospective application or retroactive, I think the key point in the Rogers decision that this court will either follow or not follow is in the majority opinion in Roman numeral 2 in the fifth paragraph. And in that paragraph...
What page is that, do you know?
I have a computer printed version.
Fine.
But it's Roman numeral 2, and I've counted five paragraphs into it.
What's your computer?
It starts with, to the extent the petitioner argues that the due process clause incorporates the specific prohibitions of the ex post facto clause. And in that paragraph, after citing three quotes from the Bowie case that seem to state that due process is coextensive with the protections of due process, Justice O'Connor steps back from that analysis and said, no, due process is something different. Due process is something less. But I think the Bowie case, which goes back to the early 1960s, if I'm not mistaken, has a pedigree of its own, and that the U.S. Supreme Court, for purposes of the U.S. Constitution, is stepping back from it. I'm asking this court not to step back from Bowie, and that the analysis that the dissent applies here should apply to Mr. Picotte. There's no way to view the decision in the Rogers case as anything other than a retroactive application of the law that could never have been done had that law been legislation instead of common law. So I'm asking this court to give Mr. Picotte relief from his conviction. If there's nothing further, I see my red light's on.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Becker, for your arguments in this case. 01-3063-CR, State versus Picotte. And that concludes our arguments for today, and the court is in recess from all arguments until December 17th at 9:45. Thank you.